The Living Sea of Waking Dreams by Richard Flanagan is a very tough book, but probably the most important book I've read this year.
That's Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. And The Living Sea of Waking Dreams is one of the books she's recommending for those looking for something to take along with you on your summer vacation.
It takes place in Tasmania. And behind the set in which the action takes place, Australia is on fire. Bird species disappearing because they can't survive in the fire. In Tasmania, an old woman is on her deathbed. There are three siblings in this tale, and Anna, who really is the voice of the novel, begins to question her own life. And in the midst of all this, she looks down at her hand one day, and it isn't there. This happens to her more than once. Different body parts go missing. Nobody notices. Everybody in the world is looking at their cell phone and not looking out. The doctors are looking at their computers and not their patients. Nobody is looking at Anna. Nobody's looking at anybody.
Heading to her hotel, instead of thinking, instead of feeling, she frantically searched missing fingers on her phone. Nothing of relevance. Missing knee, nothing. Missing ear, nothing. She tried. Lost and disappeared. Nothing. She felt as if drunk, reaching for a table or a chair to steady herself and finding nothing there to hold. She began thumbing a question on Twitter. Has anyone else noticed body parts going? But of course, no one would have. That was the point. No one ever saw her. No one ever did. Not even the doctor. Only her possibly demented mother saw Anna not as a thing, a type, but as a suffering human being. Anna deleted the line and swiped to a newsfeed. Numerous species had vanished forever in the fires that she'd been drinking. There weren't even enough bees left. Fire smoke was traveling all around the world. A politician was saying they shouldn't waste another word talking about climate change, but simply adapt and become more resilient. How did you adapt to your own murder? Wondered Anna as she watched a cat video. Was that what was happening? Were they adapting to their own extinction? Was she?
The world is ending. People are turned away from each other. Species are disappearing. It's painful to read that, but you know what? It's true. It's what's happening to us.
Betsy Burton. We heard the actor Essie Davis reading from The Living Sea of Waking Dreams by Richard Flanagan. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Well, the coast isn't exactly clear yet for this pandemic that we've all been living through for more than a year, but there are reasons for optimism and some signs that we're headed back into some kind of normalcy, which means, of course, for a lot of us, summer vacations. These getaways will probably still be different, but it seems as though most people are ready to venture out. And that means, of course, that you're going to need a good book to take with you to the lake or the ocean or the campsite. So today it's our annual summer book show, which we always do in the spring to get you ready. We have with us our panel of experts with us to offer titles for you to consider. And you may want to have something close by to write with, but if not, we have a list of all of the books that we'll talk about, even those we won't get to, on our website, radiowest.org. Joining us today is Catherine Weller. She's the new book buyer for Weller Bookworks. That's at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Kat, welcome back.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be back.
Ken Sanders is back with us. He's, of course, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City. Ken, welcome back to you.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
Betsy Burton is back with us, co-owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake City. And Betsy, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
If you own a small business or a restaurant or a shop or a bookstore, these days must feel something like the day after a really big storm where you step out and take a look at how you've weathered everything. And that's kind of where I wanted to begin there. Briefly, tell us, how do you think you've all done weathering the storm?
Well, I can say that we operated as a warehouse, as a mini Amazon, yeah, for over a year. And when we opened on April 1st, I knew joy. I just hated running a warehouse. It was wonderful to be able to connect with our customers, but really it's, you need to see people face to face and talk to them to truly be a bookseller, I think. And it's just a joy to be back with people in the store. We're being very careful.
Sure.
Limited numbers and masks and all of that, but people are in the store now and I am overjoyed.
Catherine, you have people back there in the shop as well, right?
Yeah, we do. We do. We do still require masks because not all of our employees are vaccinated and we've got to protect people still. You know, I think the whole pandemic, we can think of it the way I just thought of it when you mentioned everybody coming back. We got by with a little help from our friends. You know, all of us every day got by with a little help from our friends, whether it was an email from a customer who said, I hope you're doing okay. All of the orders that came in through e-commerce, all of the support that was given to us in so many different ways. We got by because people are great.
They are.
There were some dark and scary moments there, and I still have some dark and scary moments, but the power of a bookstore, the power of readers coming together, it is best face-to-face, hands down. And we wouldn't be here if our friends, if our customers, if our community didn't support us through that time.
Yeah. Ken, what about you? How are you feeling?
There are six of us at full-time employees at my shop. All six are vaccinated. We are just on the verge of we've been open since last September after Labor Day on an appointment-only basis. We're on the verge of giving up on that at this point. Like I said, everyone is vaccinated. The majority of our clientele is. We're not going to go there to ask them if they are or not or ask proof. We're going to keep the mask wearing for now until the numbers truly are low enough. And I think we've got a big Memorial Day weekend to get through to see what happens there, if there's yet another spike. So we're nervously looking forward. The most interesting thing and a shock to me, because, you know, I'm kind of the dreamer and the big picture guy, and the devil's always in my details, is when my CPA told me I had to write out a check to the Utah State Tax Commission for twice as much money that I have ever had to send them ever before, I was somewhat flabbergasted. And what that means is we're doing less big ticket sales out of state and less big ticket sales to non-top taxpaying entities like libraries, and the sales of new and used and even rare books to in-state people that we have to collect and pay the sales tax have gone through the roof. They've more than doubled in the first quarter of 2021. I hate having to pay all that money, but we have to, and it's a healthy sign, Doug.
Yeah. So I want to transition into books here pretty quickly, but one final thing I am wondering, do you think, I think a lot of us, and maybe I'm off on this, but it seemed like that a lot of people were in the pandemic hunkering down, doing a lot more reading maybe than they did in the past. And I'm wondering if you think some of those trends will stay. I guess the question is, has this pandemic and the experience of it, as we're sort of starting to come out of it, has it changed the way people read books or think about books or buy books in any way? Let's take just a few minutes to talk about that.
Well, I absolutely think it has. I think that people are reading more. The people that typically bought maybe 5 books in a month, or probably were buying 10 during the pandemic. I absolutely think that was true. The other thing that's really interesting that's changed is the internet ordering that Kat mentioned, which was a very small part of our business, is now actually a much larger part. And I'm hoping that that doesn't change, because it gives us a kind of a multifaceted business that we didn't have before, and makes us stronger, I think. So I think people, I hope people keep ordering that way. And there's some connection, you know, you get up in the middle of the night, you turn on your computer and you've heard about a book you want, and you just order it on the internet. It's a whole different kind of shopping. Yeah. And it's good for us.
I'm glad that's good for you, because that didn't seem like it always would have been good for independent booksellers, but it seems like it is. Kat, what do you think?
Yeah, we have seen a return of sales via the net. I saw sales to customers I haven't seen in a long time. And I think it's because people started thinking about community. You know, one of the things I've harped on all along, including on this show, is what's the world you want to live in when this is over with?
Yeah.
Everybody talks about how everything's going to change. Is it really? What are you going to do to make it change? And what I'm seeing is people coming back to independent bookstores, not just by walking through the door, but by shopping with us online as well. Yeah. So that's definitely a positive. And being able to weather that, have multiple income streams, is really important for an independent bookstore and a small business. Yeah. So it's really positive.
All right, before we get to books, Ken Sanders, you want a final word there before we jump in?
Newsflash, Doug, that people are sifting through their priorities this pandemic downtime. They're truly examining what their beliefs are, what they care about. And guess what? It's independent bookstores and independent restaurants and bodegas, and not the Damazons of the world. And they're voting with their pocketbooks online. We are primarily a used and rare book store. We have lots of new books, but I would guess that our new book sales have gone up tenfold in the past year. People are making an effort to spend money on things and people and places that they believe in. That is not going to change. It's going to increase.
Okay. Well, that's good news. I have to say that was kind of encouraging hearing from all of you on that score. All right, let's stay with Ken and jump in. Let's hear some books. Ken Sanders, give us some ideas.
Okay, N. Scott Momaday, he has a new book out called Earthkeeper. N. Scott Momaday is one of possibly the first generation of Native American writers in America to start recording the indigenous experience. And of course, that is a booming, huge, rich, rich field of indigenous writers and people. He's still with us, and his new book is called Earthkeeper, Reflections on the American Land, and he's still got it. And going with classics, Margaret Atwood, she has a new volume of poetry out called Dearly, New Poems by Margaret Atwood. And talk about having endurance. She's written way more than 50 books now. Betsy N.O. has brought her here multiple times. And of course, she's internationally famous because of the Handmaid's Tale. But she began her writing life as a poet, and her roots are deep in poetry, and her prose reflects her deep love and knowledge of poetry. And this is a fabulous new book for poetry lovers called Dearly. And it's her newest and freshest poetry. Then I want to keep going with the classics, but I want to go to South of the Border, because another old friend of Betsy's, Isabel Allende, who I got, it was so much fun to getting to meet her when Betsy brought her in for the big opening of our brand new library about 10 years ago or so. What a delightful, interesting person. I had a great time meeting her. She, long before her famous book, This House of Spirits, I showed her a copy of it, and she really pretended to be mad about it at the time, that this, I can't give you the name in Spanish, but her first book was a feminist screed called all men are troglodytes. Where did you get that book? I thought I had destroyed every copy. here she is with a new, she just got, Betsy would know better. She just got married again. And she's written this new book called The Soul of a Woman. And like Allende, like Mama Day, she's out there and she's still pitching it finally, her fellow Chilean, Robert Bolano, has got a brand new book called Cowboy Graves, and it's three novellas. And he and Allende are both fellow Chileans, although neither of them live there anymore. And it's a really, really rich time for people of all kinds of ethnicities writing and publishing really good books.
Yeah. Great. Ken, thanks very much. Betsy Burton, off to you.
Yeah, I'm going to start with Catherine Coles. She is a poet here, was our poet laureate. And this new book of hers is not poetry, but in a way it really is poetry. Mm-hmm. It's called The Stranger I Become on Walking, Looking, and Writing. And it is exactly as the title describes. She starts out walking, and Kate is a walker. She walks the city tirelessly every single day. And then she travels for her job because she's internationally known all the time. And she walks there, too. So she's walking. Her mind is emptying. She's observing. She's really seeing. And those are things that are important to a poet, to have those skills. And then writing comes into the picture because of that. And then as she's talking about writing, she talks about creativity and how ideas come, and she begins to dissect poetry. And then, of course, she brings in her favorite poets, chief among them, Emily Dickinson. So it's just, and it's so beautifully written. It is so poetic. And in the end, even though this is prose, it is poetry. Anybody who loves poetry would just treasure this. It's a small, beautiful paperback. The Stranger I Become by Catherine Coles.
Great.
Then, on a very different note, The Anthropocene Reviewed by John Green. I assume I'm saying that right. He takes, you know, there are the ages like Pleistocene, the geological ages. We are now in one that is man-formed, the Anthropocene Reviewed. And he takes pieces of humanity all over the place, and he reviews them. One star, five stars. He gives a plague one stars. He gives a soccer player five stars. Tells a picture of the story of the soccer game, which is wonderful. He gives sycamores five stars, and the reason is he's crashed. He's in a terrible depression. He can't move. He looks out. He sees a sycamore. He sees that peeling bark, and everything lifts. This is just the most interesting book. You can pick it up and put it down, little pieces, all reviewed, and seeing how he reviews things is fascinating, but the pieces are even more so. Then Peter Wolveen, The Heartbeat of Trees, the subtitle, Embracing Our Ancient Bond with Nature. And this is the man who wrote The Hidden Life of Trees, which really informed and inspired, I think, Richard Powers' book. And this takes that book much further. It's the system and heartbeat and every physical thing about trees and how trees replicate human beings and their society replicates the society of human beings. He gets actually a little woo-woo a couple of times. But it's okay because what he's saying, you really do believe as you're reading the book. And I just was fascinated. And then finally, on a very different note, The Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty by Patrick Radin Keith. This is a story of, first of all, at the beginning of their dynasty, Valium, and then OxyContin. So it's a story of Big Pharma, but it's a story of this fascinating, horrific family who Arthur, the scion of the family, manipulated the FDA and the IRS and the Metropolitan Museum and the Smithsonian Museum, all for good name. And in the end, they are infamous for having the worst name in the history of American corporate skullduggery. I mean, there's nobody who's done more. You know, hundreds of thousands of people died. They made billions. We lost trillions. It's just a horrific story. And you can't put it down when you're reading it. The Empire of Pain.
Empire of Pain. Great. Catherine Weller.
Hey, I'm going to start with one of those big histories that I like. This book is called The Gun, The Ship, and the Pen. Its subtitle, as always, is a little more self-explanatory, Warfare, Constitutions, and the Making of the Modern World by Linda Coley. This is a great book because it uses it as an entry into one of the pivotal times of history, which was those late 1700s, early 1800s into the early 1900s, where suddenly nations were controlling their environments and other nations, not just by wars, but by law. And so the role of the Constitution becomes very, very important. And it is just fascinating to read this retelling of modern history through the rise and red of a written constitution and what that means for a country. Wow. She does a lot of pushing back on certain mythologies. For instance, talking about Catherine the Great was writing her enlightened version of a constitution years before the French Revolution. It was not inspired by the French Revolution at all because, no surprise, she shows that constitutions frequently serve to marginalize certain populations, indigenous persons, women, people of color, and expropriate land while advancing and enfranchising a different population entirely. It is one of those great bracing reads, and I just loved it. It was The Gun and the Ship and the Pen by Linda Coley. Another very bracing read is a book called The Turnaway Study by Diana Greene Foster. This is a book that did a 10-year study of what happens to women when they cannot get abortions or when they can get abortions, because there are a lot of narratives about what happens to women when they are unable to access legal and safe abortion. This study shows that hands down, women are actually better off when they're able to control their fertility and terminate their pregnancies. It is a data-driven study. It is not a book. It is not a policy-driven book. It's data-driven. The study is data. So it's written by an OB-GYN at the University of California, San Francisco. Absolutely fascinating. The Doctor's Blackwell has been discussed quite a bit, another medical book. It's about the Elizabeth Blackwell, who was the first practicing female physician in the United States. And people know a lot about her. I knew a lot about her. I didn't know a lot about her sister. They both practiced medicine. And one of the fascinating things is Elizabeth was a good physician, but she wasn't a good person. She didn't even really like people, never mind patients and women. Whereas her sister was more of what we think of as a physician. The trials of breaking through into medicine as women and what it meant to treat women in that time is really nicely portrayed in this book. And finally, very quickly, Mapping America's National Parks, Preserving Our Natural and Cultural Treasures by the National Park Service. What's the first thing you do when you go to a national park or when you go to their website? You get a map. This talks about how the Park Service uses maps, how the people who go to parks use maps, how maps aid in cultural preservation, preservation of the land, and how they really further the mission of the Park Service. It's fantastic.
That's great.
Those are good, guys. There's some really good stuff to read this summer. That's terrific. Okay. Catherine Weller is, of course, from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. Betsy Burton is with the King's English at 15th and 15th. And then, of course, Ken Sanders, Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. A list of the books that we mention, even the ones we won't get to, will be on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
Wendell Berry is a poet, farmer, novelist, essayist, who has been writing and publishing more than 60 books over 60 some odd years. He is plain spoken, and Wendell Berry always tells the truth. And he has a new edition of a 1980s essay entitled, Why I'm Not Going to Buy a Computer.
A number of people by now have told me that I could greatly improve things by buying a computer. My answer is that I am not going to do it. I have several reasons, and they are good ones. The first is the one I mentioned at the beginning. I would hate to think that my work as a writer could not be done without a direct dependence on strip-mined coal. How could I write conscientiously against the rape of nature if I were, in the act of writing, implicated in the rape? For the same reason, it matters to me that my writing is done in the daytime.
The essay first appeared in Harper's Magazine and engendered an enormous amount of reader mail, almost all of it negative. And he answers every one of them in this new edition.
I do not see that computers are bringing us one step nearer to anything that does matter to me. Peace, economic justice, ecological health, political honesty, family and community stability, good work.
Let's give Wendell the last word, Doug. Finally, it seems to me that none of my correspondents or critics recognizes the innovativeness of my essay.
If the use of a computer is a new idea, then a newer idea is not to use one.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You heard the actor Nick Offerman there reading Wendell Berry from the essay collection The World Ending Fire, The Essential Wendell Berry. Today in the program, it's our annual summer book show where we gather our panel of book experts to give you ideas for your vacation season reading. And, of course, we have with us, as always, Ken Sanders from Ken Sanders Rare Books, Betsy Burton from the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City, 15th and 15th there, and Catherine Weller from the Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. And let's jump back in. Betsy Burton, back to you.
I'm going to talk about some fiction now. And one of my very favorite novels that's brand new, just coming out, is The Vixen by Francine Prose. Francine Prose is a wonderful writer, and her last book, Welcome to the Chameleon Club, was about Paris, 1932, and captured that city. This captures New York in the early 50s, absolutely captures it. And although we're used to reading books of that time, the McCarthy era, this is nothing like anything you've ever read. Simon Putnam has studied folklore and wants nothing more than to be a professor of folklore. But he can't get a job, so he starts to work for a publishing house. And the first project he's given is to edit a biography of Ethel Rosenberg. And the book portrays her as this Mata Hari who's much more interested in sex than communism. And this poor young man is befuddled. He doesn't know why they've even given him a book. And his mother is a close friend of Ethel Rosenberg. So how can he do this? But he has to justify it to himself. So he falls in love with the author just off the cover from the book and fantasizes about her every night. He falls in love with the woman who he's replaced in the publishing house. He falls in love with the assistant to the owner of the publishing house. He isn't a philanderer. He's too naive. He's sort of like a character out of Nabokov. too funny to be believed. This is a very funny book. But underneath the funny, prose captures that era of New York in a dark and deadly way. And by the end of the book, you realize you're kind of reading about our present right now. Vixen by Francine Prose.
Right.
It's just a wonderful book. Light Perpetual by Francis Spufford. He's a wonderful British writer. This is an odd book. It takes the bombing, 1944, of a Woolworth's. 168 people have been killed, 15 of them children. He takes five of those children and follows their stories through time as if they lived, reinvents their life, all the way up to 2009 when they're 69. Fascinating, beautifully written. The spirit of Great Britain during those years is so there. He is a wonderful writer who isn't well enough known. Then I'm going to talk for just a minute about, instead of, well, it's fiction, but An Unlikely Spy by Rebecca Starford. This is a woman who, as a child, was sort of not socially acceptable, and she learned to prevaricate, to pretend she was somebody that who she wasn't. And what better training for a spy than that? So she grows up a closely held friend of a very well-to-do family who find her a job in the war effort, and she becomes a spy. And it's about what happens to her as a spy and how that closed off world she learns to live in affects a human being. It's a wonderful thriller, kind of along the lines of Transformation by Kate Atkinson. So again, that is An Unlikely Spy by Rebecca Starford. And just quickly, Trio by William Boyd takes place in Brighton in the 60s. They're making a movie. The main characters are the producer, the director's wife, who was a writer until people kept comparing her to Virginia Woolf. She hates Virginia Woolf and she quit writing, and an ingenue. And these people are writing a terrible movie. And as they work on it, it becomes worse and worse. So it's a very funny, slightly romantic novel, captures the 60s in Great Britain, and I loved it. It's called Trio, and it's by William Boyd.
Great. Okay, Catherine Weller, back to you.
Hey, my first book is a challenge to describe. Eladat by Sashu Foster and Arturo Romero. It is published by the Mighty City Lights Press in San Francisco, sister business to City Lights, the independent bookshop. This book is so much. It is, on the face of it, you could say it is surrealist fiction. I'm just going to start there. It is this amazing, strange world in the early 20th century where airships, dirigibles, are used in East Los Angeles as a form of revolutionary, sort of clandestine movement throughout the area. There are places like the East LA Balloon Club and the Bessie Coleman Aero Club who are trying to revolutionize travel to ultimately lift people out of poverty and empower oppressed people who are being held down by the conventions of society at the time. This book, it's like, I heard the author describe it as a prism, and it's very prismatic. If you are a person that needs a strong narrative, do not read this book. if you are a person who is open to really fantastic hybrids, well-researched books that are send-ups on academia, on novel, on political fiction, this book is for you. It is, if you are one of those people that's getting into Leonora Carrington again, turn to Eladat at the end, because it is just a big, crazy ride to pull yourself into and out of. That's Eladat by Sashu Foster and Arturo Romero. My next book is a little more traditional in that this has been done a lot lately. A Thousand Ships by Natalie Haynes is one of those books that is of the vogue right now, in which a feminist writer goes back and retells some of classic literature. Natalie Haynes is giving voice to the women of of the war for Troy. She weaves this narrative where the voices of the Trojan women throughout the whole siege, and then as they're waiting to be basically distributed as prizes to the invaders, she weaves that story with the story of the women who were left behind by people like Odysseus, who were going off to fight the Trojan War. It is a lovely retelling of that story. The way the story weaves together is just fantastic. That's A Thousand Ships by Natalie Haynes.
Great.
A Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead also weaves a couple of narratives together. This is the story of a disappeared aviatrix. Think of Amelia Earhart. And the actress who was hired many years later to play her, and the research that she does. This is just a really just skillfully done weaving of the tales of both the aviator and of the actress, and the challenges that they both have within those times.
Huh.
It's called A Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead.
Wow. All right, Ken Sanders, what else do you have for us?
Well, speaking of trees, Doug, I listened to a NPR show in the past week of all about this interview with this author, Suzanne Simard, who has just published this new book called Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. Mm-hmm. And I was just absolutely blown away by it. Mm-hmm. She has been doing these scientific studies on trees for quite some time. And well, sorry, Professor, but she's a tree torturer is what she really is. So she gives these trees diseases and horrible diseases and bark beetles, and then she studies them. And she's learned that the tree she's infecting through its roots sends this tree juice, for lack of a better word, down into the root systems and out to the other trees and warns them. And the tree doesn't just talk to its own species, it talks to all the species in the forest. And then she comes back a time frame later and retortures a whole bunch of trees and discovers that the first tree that she tortured has sent out signals to all the other trees, and they've built up their defenses and they can repel the disease now. But that's just the beginning. She's done such intense studies of these trees that she's discovered that in terms of forestry sense, we all know we've managed our forest in this country the wrong way for 200 years now, but it's worse than that. The clear cutting is terrible. What you've got to do is leave a grove of trees. You've got to leave a certain percentage of the matriarchs and the patriarchs and the little trees. And that way, the big trees, a tree knows when it's dying. It might take a tree 20 to 50 years to die. So it sends out all its good tree juice to the little trees to make them healthy and thrive in the forest that it knows that it won't be there any longer. And not necessarily lastly, but during this whole years of research and study the scientists did, she went through her own personal bout with cancer. And one of the new drugs they're using on the cancer treatment front is made from this tree juice. And our shipment hasn't come in. I haven't been able to read the book yet, but I can't wait. That's my favorite new book. And I apologize to the scientists for calling it tree torture.
Well, say the name of the book again.
Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest by Suzanne Simard.
Wow.
Next up is University of Utah Press is doing some great local stuff. The Last Canyon Voyage is a filmmaker's journey down the Green and Colorado Rivers, retracing the 1869 and later journeys of John Wesley Powell and Company in 1955 as they were beginning to dam Glen Canyon on the Colorado. The film, he finished the film. It came out, sort of forgotten about now, but now all of his diaries and journals about that final before dam Colorado trip have been published for the first time. I'm very, very excited about that. On a local note, We have a really quirky book from Signatures Books called Spencer Kimball's Record Collection by Michael Hicks. And it's clearly not a biography, but this is this man's account of a very insightful. He was pals with one of Spencer W. Kimball's, yes, the LDS Church's prophet, seer, and revelator, is his record collection. And it's just quirky, it's fun, and it gives a human side to a Mormon prophet.
Wow. Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City. Betsy Burton also with us, of course, from the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. And Catherine Weller is with us from Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square in Salt Lake. A list of the books we've talked about, even the ones we won't get to, all of them, will be on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
In her book, Four Lost Cities, Annalee Newitz writes about four civilizations that rose to great heights and then collapsed. 9,000 years ago, there was a massive city in central Turkey.
Thousands of people, far more than most humans saw in a lifetime, were living together in one seemingly endless village.
We meet a woman that archaeologists named Dido, who in a lot of ways was a very typical inhabitant of the city.
Dido lived in a house made from sun-baked clay and wooden beams, its interior walls plastered white and painted with abstract designs in red ochre. Like a modern woman living in New York or Istanbul, Dido might sometimes have mused on the generations who raised children here before her, but most days would have been devoted to more ordinary concerns.
She climbed a ladder to walk out through her front door every morning,
and then emerged into an environment created entirely by human hands. To fetch food and water, Dido strolled between rooftop workshops, goat pens.
We've lived in cities a very long time. How we live in cities changes, but the way we come together in cities and the way our cities dissolve have some similarities that we can use to better inform how we live our lives now.
That was Chloe Cannon reading from Four Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age by Annalee Newitz. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So it's the first day of the Memorial Day weekend, which marks the first day of the vacation season for a lot of us. And for those who want to bring a book along, we are here for you, as we are every year. We have with us our panel of book enthusiasts from some of the local bookstores in Salt Lake City. They have a lot of ideas for you. With us is Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Betsy Burton from the King's English Bookshop, and Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks. All right, let's jump back in. Catherine Weller, get us started here again.
All right, so for those of us who are parents who are going outside, Temple Grandin has a new book called The Outdoor Scientist, The Wonder Observing the Natural World. This is a book for kids, and it has 40 projects in it to help kids access the scientific and natural world principles that she's talking about in each chapter in which she interviews a particular scientist and talks about her own experiences in these parts of the world. It is just such a neat book to dive into. You can do it from your backyard, but you can also take it on the road on those vacations everybody wants to take. It's called The Outdoor Scientist, and it is by Temple Grandin. Next is a picture book. The words were done by Matt De La Pena, and the pictures are by Christian Robinson. It's called Milo Imagines the World, And it starts with this boy who is getting on a train to go someplace where he always goes once a month. And it's just quite a story. He is looking at everybody on the train, making up stories about them, thinking about them, worrying about what they think about him. And when he gets to the prison where his family member is incarcerated, he starts thinking about the people he saw on the train differently and thinking about how we're tempted to judge people by how they look, a book by its cover, if you will. But really, there's more to life than that, more to people than that. It's just a beautiful book. It's called Milo Imagines the World by Matt De La Pena. And finally, Rio Cortez and Lauren Summer did a great book, so vibrant, called The ABCs of Black History. This is a picture book, not a board book, but it is an ABCdarium. And you know X is for Malcolm X, but it's for a lot of other concepts in Black history. It's a wonderful stroll for young people, very young, through the topic.
Great. Okay. All right, Ken Sanders, let's have some children's books ideas.
My fave, Doug, is She Made a Monster, How Mary Shelley Created Frankenstein by Lynn Fulton, illustrated by Felicita Sala. It's a young person's picture book. It has just wonderful, wonderful, offbeat artwork that's kind of brooding, as the story is. It has wonderful insights into the novel, but it's written for children, but it really, adults can learn something from it too. It's a beautifully illustrated and beautiful telling of Mary Shelley, her famous feminist mother, and the whole creation of Frankenstein's monster that is more than the Boris Karloff version.
Yeah.
Next up is We Are Water Protectors. This is a book written by two Native Americans, both women, Carol Lindstrom and Michaela Goad. It's a Caldecott Medal winner. And it's a delightful story about water, which to the Native American people, water is medicine. And it's beautifully illustrated and written story. And it's great because it doesn't have an ending or a conclusion. That's what I like about it the best. Finally up, Neil Gaiman, the famous Neil Gaiman,
yeah,
written many, many books for adults and children. He's got a brand new one out called Pirate Stew. Neil Gaiman, and it's illustrated by Chris Riddle, and it's just a fun, nonsensical book with absolutely gorgeous artwork. Pirate Stew, Neil Gaiman, We Are Water Protectors, Lindstrom and Goad, and She Made a Monster by Lynn Fulton. Those are my three picks.
Terrific. Okay, Betsy Burton, over to you.
Okay, I'm going to start with a book called Desert Diary. It's Japanese American Kids Behind Barbed Wire. It's by Michael Tunnell. I'm starting with it because, I mean, we had Lily Havey's wonderful book. We all know about Topaz. But right now, because of what's happening to Asian Americans in our country, I think this is so timely. And it's a kind of a different take on Topaz because it is a class diary of third graders. That is the substance of the book, telling the tale from their own point of view. There are pictures, there's a little history, but by and large, what you see is what the children see every day. It's very moving, it's very informative, and I just loved it. Desert Diary, Michael Tunnell. Then, now here on a very different note, is a kid's book for people with broad minds. It's called Fred Gets Dressed. And Fred loves to run around the house naked. The pictures are hysterical. I mean, this little kid is zooming around the house 90 miles an hour with no clothes on. His parents are just kind of, you know, paying no attention. He happens upon his father's closet and he tries on a few things and he's kind of disappointed in the look. So he goes to his mother's closet and he tries on a blouse that's just perfect as a dress. So he belts it up and he puts on some high heels and out he goes. And in the end, the family end up sort of making him up and making him quite a beautiful female. And that seems to be the way that he ends up, except in the last scene, he is seen running away and his bottom is bare. It's a stunningly funny kids book and I just loved it. Fred Gets Dressed. Just quickly, Itty Bitty Kitty Corn by Shannon Hale, our wonderful Shannon Hale, is a charming tale of a cat who wants to be a unicorn and a unicorn who would really prefer to be a cat. It is, you know, about sharing feelings, and it's wonderful. Itty Bitty Kitty Corn by Shannon Hale.
Okay. All right, let's do a lightning round. Gosh, Betsy, go first, and then we'll spin through as many as we can.
Okay, The Committed by Nguyen, I believe. It's the sequel to The Sympathizer, and it's just brilliant. The Year Abroad by Shang Rei Li, a book like none other about a young man's year abroad.
Great. Kat, give us a couple.
The Night Always Comes by Willie Vlautin. Willie is really a modern troubadour on page, like he used to be musically. This is about gentrification. Also, The Final Revival of Alpo and Nev by Donnie Walton. This is another book about music, which we all know is hard to write about. This is about a group in the 70s and riots and racial justice and the music industry.
Wow. Ken Sanders.
Well, if you ever wanted to think about where all of these current radical ideas on the right wing have come out of in the past few years, you might want to go back to the source in the 1950s, new U of U Press title called Watchman on the Tower, Ezra Taft Benson and the Making of the Modern Right by Matthew Harris. It's a stunning look into incredible right-wing practices at the height of McCarthyism in the 1950s. On a completely different note, Jeremy Pugh and the late Mary Brown Maloof, Secret Salt Lake City, a really irreverent guide to all kinds of goofy, goofy things that occur here. And as we all know, there's no place goofier than here.
It's the truth. It's Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books on Second East in Salt Lake City. Betsy Burton also with us from the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. Thank you all very much for being with us. A lot of good books here, don't you think?
Yes. Oh,
lots.
If you didn't get a chance to write down the titles, don't worry. We have all of them on our website, the ones we talked about and the ones we didn't quite get to, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you or on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.